This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
This episode is brought to you by La Quinta by Wyndham. Your work can take you all over the place, like Texas. You've never been, but it's going to be great because you're staying at La Quinta by Wyndham. Their free bright side breakfast will give you energy for the day ahead. And after, you can unwind using their free high-speed Wi-Fi. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book your stay today at LQ.com.
In 1924, André Breton, the principal theorist of surrealism, penned the Manifesto of Surrealism. In it, he questions why we don't trust that our dream world is real. Its scale and scope may bend beyond our waking grasp, and its texture and rules may be so different, but if we can't prove it's not real, we should approach it as if it is. André and his cabal weren't satisfied with just questioning. They applied their curiosities to art and literature in ways that confused and enlivened. And while I don't share their colonial desire to measure and classify our dream world, I do share and aspire to the surrealist provocation to question and then breach our limits. If dreams point to doors that we're taught to keep shut, why not open them? Questioning our limits is a salient and consequential concern. And my guest today is a wonderful example of the surrealist quest in action. I'm in conversation with Elijah McKinnon, the founder and executive diva of Open Television, or OTV, a platform and media incubator for intersectional storytelling. Elijah's insights into how their imagination is supported and encouraged by their pragmatism made me think and reflect on how I engage with my own. If we understand the imagination as a reality of the mind, and if the mind is neurally networked to environments beyond the self, productive possibilities can only emerge from the application of our imagination in the so-called real world. It's not all highfalutin philosophy today, y'all. Together, we explore the difference between surrender and intentional release, the differing demands of and confusion between transparency and vulnerability, and refusing to be bound by other people's ideas and labels. Elijah reflects on their stewardship of OTV, the care required to sustain artistic vitality, and how an entitlement to softness has transformed their sense of duty to themselves and the communities they love. I'm Josh Rivers, and I'm busy being Black with Elijah McKinnon. Elijah, thank you so much for joining me on Busy Being Black. We've been having a conversation about having you on the show for what feels like an eternity. And I'm so glad that it's happening now on the 8th anniversary of OTV. I'm so proud of you and I'm so glad that you're here.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so honored and privileged to be in space with you, and I'm a deep admirer and fan of yours. So thank you for holding space for this sacred convening.
As you know, to open my conversations on Busy Being Black, I ask all of my guests the same question. How's your heart?
My heart is full of love and pleasure and wonder. I'm thinking a lot about release and letting go as opposed to surrendering. And so a lot of what fuels me and fills my heart right now is opportunities to get closer to that and to explore and be a bit more, I think, adventurous and courageous in my approach to calling what is sacred in and what is divine in, that's where my heart is right now.
Surrender is a word for me that I have tussled with. And it's so interesting to hear that you're moving away from surrender, particularly as it relates to the divine, because these two ideas, if you will, are almost always presented together, right? We surrender to some higher power, we surrender to some greater divinity, what have you. And so talk to me more about this decision to move away from surrender. What is it about release and letting go that differs from surrender?
Surrendering has and holds a space in my heart that I think and believe throughout the duration of my 20s, I had to wave the white flag, right? Like there was just moments and times where I just couldn't anymore, right? There was wisdom and knowledge that I did not have access to, and so therefore had to quite literally surrender. And I think entering into the third decade of my life has been an invitation for me to explore what it looks like to intentionally release or intentionally let go or intentionally transition. And so much, I think, of my work and my practice currently is about cultivating invitations to sunset, right? Like, how do we send things off, right? I think a good friend of mine and sister in Slayage often talks about how things need to die, right? Like, things actually need to be laid to rest so that other opportunities can bear the fruits of our labor, right? And they can really truly come alive. And so without going too far into today, I really want to get into the practice and have been getting into the practice of like radical permission. And so today, and even in our conversation, I want to be using an opportunity to submit myself into some anchors by inviting my ancestors and my elders and my guides to bring forth, right, the wisdom that I have been able to be blessed with, the privilege that I have garnered, and also just the abundance that I do get to share with the world. I think that there are permissions that we have to ask ourselves before we're even able to surrender or let go from these anchors. And for me, I think who I want to call in, or, you know, who I want to anchor in today in our conversation are a couple of people come to mind, and are a couple of ancestors and guides and elders that come to mind are Sombonfu Sume, Adrienne Marie Brown, and Patricia Lynn McKinnon, which is my mother. I want to anchor and use that as a guide for the ways in which I want to show up and allow spirit to speak through me.
I love that. I think that's a really helpful way to think about the difference between surrendering and letting go. And of course, you know, my resistance to surrender has always been, I'm not letting go of control, right? That I'm not going to be told what to do by anyone, ancestors, higher powers, my dad, nobody is going to tell me what to do. I will figure this out the hard way. But then that's also my attraction to surrender and letting go in the same vein as well, is that actually sometimes when I am gripping the steering wheel, I'm prone to veer off the cliff. So what if I do get a little bit better at letting in, right? How do I open myself up? And I think that's the journey I've been on this year is, you know, I've spoken about this on the show, we've spoken about this privately, but I'm focusing on sobriety or practicing sobriety, and so much of that is about letting myself be touched and moved by the world and not running from myself and other people and experiences. And so I've kind of got a new surrender, has a new texture for me now than it's had in previous years.
I really love that, because it also is an invitation for you, right? And I think our world to get a little bit closer to the ways in which our minds work. I think that the mind is such a fascinating, like, object that we just, like, hold within us, but also is, like, outside of us. I think that that's what's so beautiful. Is I was watching a film recently at a festival, and the point in which, like, the mind is actually influenced outside of us, right? Like, we have a mind that, right, is inside of our bodies, but it's actually influenced by what we see and what we hear and what we taste and what we touch, right? That's what actually gives our mind something to reflect and mirror back, right? As to, this is what's happening to you, or this is what is, you know, cementing your ideas around the world that is occurring around you. And I think that that's so, so beautiful to be in constant communication, right, with what is happening around you and what is happening inside of you, and how we can get in, I don't even want to say better alignment, but with just more alignment between the two. So I'm happy that this journey, in whatever practice that I think, you know, arrives at in your body, is something that feels nourishing and is, like, centered and anchored in care. Because so much around, even again, like the surrendering that you were talking about, is usually by force. And I am just trying to live a life that is anchored in duty over obligation, and that is really and truly an invitation versus, like, a forceful intrusion. And so that's where I think get really excited, that, like, when people are talking about this, I'm like, ooh, you're tuned in. Like, you understand that there's actually, like, work that we have to do collectively and individually to get to that space.
Yeah. And the last thing I'll say on that is that idea of the mind is so interesting, because it's not only that, you know, that our mind is a consequence of and always an interaction with other ideas, people, moments, experiences outside of the kind of porous border of our bodies, but also our mind extends beyond the border of the self, right? Our mind is also, you know, neurally networked, if you will, with people like us and not like us. And it really kind of troubles this distinction of the Western construct of the human, right? This kind of singular entity whose main productive goal in life, outside of reproduction and, you know, the propagation of the species, is actually to ascend some sort of individualistic higher plane, right? And so this idea that the mind actually is not confined to whatever space we believe it occupies within our body, but is actually part of some much more larger interconnected whole, I think is really invigorating as well. I'm increasingly asking people about what's enchanting them. I find we don't often ask Black people what's lighting us up and what's bringing us joy. I mean, we're getting much better asking the joy question, but I particularly love the enchanting question because I think it kicks open so many wonderful doors. So what's enchanting you at the minute?
Well, as a fantastical queen, I'm quite enchanted by very simple things. I think life is such a gift and it's so precious. And right now, I think what I'm most enchanted by is the practice of slowing down and also paring down. I think finding really beautiful, soft, tender, intimate moments to just exist beyond production or beyond labor or beyond service, right? I think is something that has just really been enchanting me, and also understanding the privilege and the luxury that is held within that pursuit and how challenged I am by that. Like, why that is a luxury and why that is a privilege to be able to slow down, and how the ways in which capitalism and just in general supremacy culture keeps us so far away from that is also what I think delights my ability to advance sort of through life this way with like that perfect balance of like grace and grit. And you know, oftentimes I am in these spaces where, you know, individuals talk about like, oh, you have this light or you hold this light. And I think for so long, because of ego, I was like, yes, I am light. And like, yes, it's me. I'm the chosen one. But what I'm actually realizing is that like, I'm a mirror, right? For those who actually don't have access to that light source, right? And so when they see me tapping into my power, it's not envy, right? It's not jealousy. It's not anger or frustration. Those may be parts of it, right? But what they're actually seeing is someone who has actually cultivated the privilege to be able to tap into that. And so many people, you know, that I get to divine with and share space with, see that as like a window, right? Like, oh, I can actually have that as well. It doesn't need to look anything like that, but I have the power within me. And so it's been a beautiful, I think, space to divine in with the people who I hold sacred and the people who really understand ritual as a form of like liberation. So those are some of the things that I think I've been musing and meditating on over the past, just like even couple of weeks.
I love that. Yes, softness. I get that energy from you. Since we've known each other, that there's this kind of well-guarded softness, and it's made me think about my own softness. You know, how do I also know that I don't just want to be able to rest. I want to be able to be soft, to be tender, to be properly vulnerable, not like a kind of sometimes I was joking with my friend the other day that the vulnerability I sometimes embody feels like a fabricated one, right? Like it's safe. I know just how vulnerable I can be, and I guard that kind of very specific vulnerability, if that makes sense. But there's still a barrier there, right? There's a barrier that I'm working on taking out little brick by brick.
Absolutely. I mean, there's something that is quickly coming up for me. I was attending a leadership training a couple of weeks ago, and a fellow executive was practicing this modeling that I really, really loved. And it was, there's a difference between being vulnerable and being transparent, right? And
right. Right.
Your face said it all. My face said it all as well.
Yeah, well, that says a lot since I was considering the amount of Botox in my face. So if you're seeing an expression, that means it's really at home.
But it's so true. You know, like, I think that many of us either fall on the spectrum of like, we can be really, really vulnerable, right, and in practice, or we can be very transparent, right, in theory. And so, oh, it's about, I think, for me, or what I've been trying to get closer to is like, how do we have a bit more balance? Because I think I'm really good at being transparent, right? Like, I'm very good at telling the truth, right? This is what's happening. And I'm learning how to become more vulnerable, right? And sharing that with people who I build trust with. And those are the things that I think are different between the two, is that like, you know, being transparent, you don't really need to establish trust, right? You don't really, you're just telling people, sure, yeah, thanks. And it's not a deeply rooted in transaction, right? I don't have to listen to your response of my transparency. Like, I don't have to be engaged.
Wow. My mind is blown, because that is a really helpful heuristic. I can't think of a more accessible word than heuristic, because I haven't thought about that transparency vulnerability dichotomy. And that actually brings up a lot of questions for me in my mind, which I'll process offline. But thank you for putting that into my orbit. I really love an Instagram post of yours. It's from a couple years ago. And so I don't know if it's even appropriate to bring up, right? We all change so much in the course of the day, let alone a couple of years, but I imagine it might still resonate with you. The post says, quote, I'm allergic to your lack of imagination. And the caption says, quote, the 2020s are death-giving flop-era vibes. Put me on ice and wake me in 2030. Or better yet, just keep me on ice and don't wake me till society has collectively decided to love, cherish, and protect Black people as much as they do their greed, ego, and patriarchy. And now, as then, it makes me think of a conversation with Patrice Cullors. She was in conversation with Krista Tippett on Being and said that, I'm paraphrasing, someone imagined chains, someone imagined guns, someone imagined death. Our job is to imagine something else. How are you tending to your imagination in this moment?
Yeah, I mean, that's a big question. And I think something that comes up for me is a quote by June Jordan. It goes, if you are free, you are not predictable, and you are not controllable, right? And so I like to think of my imagination as like a portal to a place that I know. I think sometimes we often like, or I often will think of an imaginative space as like this unknown, right? It's this other world. And like, while that can be true, right, because multiple truths can exist at once, I actually like to think of my imagination as like a place that I do know, right? It's a place that I do spend a lot of time at. It is this place that I'm very familiar with. And it brings up this notion around just like my upbringing, right? I think when I hear that question and like when I think about imagination, I didn't grow up in this incredibly like fantastical, surrealist home. My upbringing and like my roots are very like pragmatic through survival, right? Like, as you know, the child of a partnerless parent, I was taught to be pragmatic because that's how you survived, right? That's how you learned about the world around you. And I'm often quite weary of, you know, individuals who proclaim themselves to be visionary but like can't understand the difference between balancing dream with action, because we can live in a world that's like, yes, let's like interrogate all of these systems and like, let's, you know, dismantle everything, right? But if we're not simultaneously building something else, right, and placing ourselves inside of that world right now, then when we build and, you know, or when we dismantle all of these systems, and when we interrogate all of the ways in which these solutions have failed us, we are not actually prepared, right? We are not prepared and invested in what is on the other side. And so I think a lot about my imagination and the grand visions that I have and hold through action, right? So a lot of that is listening and observing. I spend a lot of time just like listening to people, listening to what they say, listening to what they don't say, so that I can deduce like where my gifts bring value to a space, right? Okay. Because oftentimes, and I'm getting really good at this, which I'm really excited about and also incredibly terrified about, is that like, I'm so good at removing my gifts from the table, right? Like, I'm really good at like, oh, these gifts are not valued, honored, or respected here. We're going to take them now, right? And we're not letting you know where they're going, right? We're not giving you coordinates. we're just saying, thank you so much. These gifts no longer hold value in this space. Best of luck to you. And I think,
or as we say, be well.
Be well. Oh my goodness, be well. Or bless your heart.
Bless your heart.
You know? Yeah. Bless your heart. Yeah. I believe that my imagination is like protected through solitude and reflection. Right. That's how I truly protect it and I guard it. And I love that you said that. Like, and I love that you pick up on that, is that there is an action and guarding one's like beauty that resides within them, not like just external beauty, but like the internal beauty. And I think of gifts as a form of that, right? Whatever gift you hold, whatever wisdom you have garnered, whatever knowledge you feel called and compelled to share, it's such a gift, right? And it's an honor that you hold that, and what you choose to do that is actually where power resides. And so for me, when I'm thinking about the imagination, I'm thinking also about like the adult learning cycle and how, like, you know, there's like experience and like action, right? And then there's like reflecting and thinking. And I feel like imagination is like right in between those like axes. Somewhere right in there is where my imagination lies.
Yeah, that's so beautiful. And you're making me think of, again, this links actually to earlier in our conversation about the mind, right? Because if we think about where we might place our imagination, right? For those of us who are more spatial in the way we think, right? We might need to place it somewhere in the body or something like that. We need to visualize it somewhere. I think that, and I'm perhaps guilty of this, not guilty, I'm perhaps prone to do this as well, to think of the imagination as a protected space, not for anyone else, that isn't necessarily a part of me, right? Mm-hmm. It's a place I have access to because I love my solitude, right? And I guard it fiercely. Mm-hmm. And I love being on my own. I find myself so entertaining, but I also just love being in my head and doing what pleases me, right? So solitude is immensely important for me. And it's also when I do that imagination tending, right? I think of my imagination mm-hmm. more as a garden, right? And so what I'm learning about now is how am I taking what's in this kind of beautiful abstract place and actually living it, right? Bringing it back, bringing the imagination into the world. I think I do that with Busy Being Black, but the things I want for myself and for other people as well too, I think it's so helpful to see the imagination as something to be shared in a more generative way.
I completely agree. And I love that you're on this journey because it also just means that everyone that you touch is also experiencing that along with you, right? In whatever ways in which it invites itself into their body. So like that to me is what is so powerful. And it actually brings up a quote from, it reminds me of a quote of Patrice Cullors around, like, you know, we can feel sad, we can feel hurt, we can feel demoralized, right? But like, we can't give up, right? That's like the nucleus. Like, we can feel all of these things, right? And every one of them can be true. But like, as long as we find some form of inspiration and drive to push us forward, like, that's the imaginative space that I want to be in. I was asked the other day, like, you know, oftentimes people are like, ask me, what do I do? And I'm just like, oh, I'm a pop star, or like, I'm an executive diva. And I'm like, because like, I won't be bound by some title or some, you know, idea or identity that you believe is what allows me to move throughout the world, right? What allows me to move throughout the world is my agency and autonomy over my fucking body, right? Like, that's it. And then whatever wig I decide to put on,
yeah,
it is what I, right, have imagined, right? So like, if I choose to wear a short kinky bob, then that's what it is today,
yeah,
right? It's a short kinky bob day. But tomorrow it may give, like, you know, a 40-inch yakky unit. And like, that's my imagination. And I think that that's what's so beautiful about also being Black and queer and holding the intersections that reside within them, is that there is this other space that we get to tap into that I'm just really, really excited that you're doing as well. Kindred spirits.
Busy Being Black returns in just a moment.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
I'm Josh Rivers, and you're listening to Busy Being Black. My conversation today is with Elijah McKinnon, the founder and executive diva of OTV, a nonprofit streaming platform and media incubator for intersectional storytelling. This year, OTV celebrates 8 years of transforming the way film, television, and entertainment industries support communities like ours. Elijah says the transformative impact of the platform is maintained by both modeling the world we want to live in and through anchoring artistic vitality in care and community. And before we jump back in, be sure to check the show notes for a link to sign up for Field Notes, Busy Bee and Black's newsletter offering to encourage your wanderlust.
Congratulations on 8 years of OTV. It's a tremendous accomplishment. I think for those who don't know, it might be helpful for you to talk about what OTV is first as a vision and then what it does in the world as in action, as you might say.
I love that question. And I, one, cannot believe I'm old enough to be the founder of an organization that is 8 years old. I feel like I'm just like, what was I doing? Like, why didn't no one tell me? Shouldn't I have been out in the streets somewhere? But I think, yes, 8 years, it's quite lovely and such an honor to be able to continue doing this work and to have watched so many, you know, organizations that have, you know, started around our, you know, inception that are unfortunately no longer here or, you know, that are continuing to do this great work. It's like just amazing to be in an ecosystem that is actively challenging the way in which media portrays and, you know, identifies and mobilizes and activates like our stories, right? Stories of intersectional people, stories that are oftentimes missing from, you know, not only the big screen, but even like what small screens, right? They're really, really challenged by our brilliance. And so OTV really serves as an intervention of just a new way, an alternative way, right, of making media. And so through our work over the last 8 years, we have arrived at a nonprofit streaming platform as well as media incubator that really centers artistic vitality and expression by intersectional artists. Intersectional artists really being defined by individuals who are marginalized not only by market, but also society because of the race, gender, sexuality, nationality, disability, or other identity markers that keep them, right, from not only entering the market, but also allowing their stories to be told authentically. And so what we've done over the past 8 years is really develop an ecosystem that is really void of the ways in which media has dictated the way that our stories get not only told, but the way that they arrive to our communities. And so we really sit kind of right at that intersection of, yes, empowering artists, but also engaging community. And oftentimes, as a, you know, media network or a platform or an incubator, you really have to kind of take one on, right? It's either you're going to engage in the artist or you're going to really stimulate the community. And what we've been able to do so beautifully over the last, you know, 8 years is build, you know, a community that really supports our artist. And that is what I think continues to bring me back to this work and helps motivate new and exciting ways to engage in this really volatile industry.
A phrase that stands out to me is artistic vitality. And just this morning, I was reading an essay by Okwi Enwezor, the late art critic and curator. I hope I'm saying his name correctly. I should have YouTubed him giving a speech or something. But he's basically responsible for a reintroduction or kind of a recalibration of the lens through which Black African people are seen in the art world. So he did these kind of huge installations and exhibitions, Documenta 15 or Documenta 11, the Venice Biennale. He did these huge interventions to kind of challenge the kind of white Western vampiric lens, a way of looking at Black African people. And I've also been reading John Berger, the late art critic, who challenged our ways of seeing and understanding art as a product of an artist who was going through things and experiencing the world and trying to say something, and that we have to pay more attention to the life of the artist. And so I guess artistic vitality is really standing out to me in this moment, particularly as it relates to the building of a community as well. I mean, how do you think about artistic vitality as something to aspire to and nurture? I guess, how do you do it is what I'm asking. How do you vitalize the artist?
Oh, that is such a stunning question. I mean, I think it centers care. It centers care over production and extractive practices. I think that there is just history that dates beyond me, right? And several decades beyond me, around the harmful and extractive nature of the film and entertainment and media landscape, right? Just as a whole. And so I believe, and OTV's mission believes, that through a two-pronged approach, right, in terms of a theory of change, is that we all know, right, through working knowledge and just what is happening in our world, that like the media ecosystem, right, is very, very volatile to individuals who hold multiple marginalized identities, right? And we don't even need to get into them because of the ways in which we universally know how challenged, right, this ecosystem is. And so our, you know, theory of change really posits itself to repair that, right? Like, how do we really repair that? What are the ways in which we need to isolate and specifically call in the opportunities to minimize harm? So like, that's one. And then two, simultaneously, we got to build a whole new thing, right? Because like, we can't wait for that harm to be repaired. So we got to do something else on the periphery. And so when I think of artistic vitality, and when I think about the ways of an artist having everything that they need to feel nourished and empowered, I think about bravery. And again, this is just through our theory of change, that in the ways in which our artists have come to us and been empowered, right, to say, this is what I want, this is what I need, that has a ripples effect in a sector, right? Because once you expose someone to a possibility model, they can't unlearn that, right? It's actually, I was just doing some like random research around like neurodivergence, and like, it's actually impossible for the like brain to unlearn something. Like, you don't unlearn it. You can like isolate, but it doesn't, you don't unlearn, right? There's no like removed from brain. It's not like a control alt delete, you know? So what it is it's actually sparking opportunities for people to recall things that they've experienced. And bravery is such a big piece of the work that we do, because it's not only providing an access point for someone who has a lived experience where they maybe have not been able to be incredibly brave, right? Or not had the opportunity to be, you know, steeped and surrounded in courageous opportunities or conversations. But when they leave, right, from whatever, you know, canon or opportunity or experience that we have been able to activate, they know that it exists, right? It's real. And so when I think of artistic vitality, I'm thinking about something that is sustained through an ecosystem, right? It isn't something that is, you know, elected, right? And it isn't something that is done in isolation. It's something that everyone has to subscribe to, or it doesn't work. And what I love about the work that we get to do, and what I love about the stories that we get to amplify, is that they're coming from, you know, the heart, right? And I talked about this a lot with Marvin Maddox over at FGUK, around like how storytelling is heart's work, right? It really is heart's work. And so we get to do that, and we get to center it in a way that reminds artists that like, your gifts bring value to the space however they're arriving. And we are here to help you nourish that to the best of our abilities, so that when you re-engage in the big big wild world, right? You're able to anchor in something that is tangible, right? That you created, that is of you, that no one can take away. And that, like, that is vital, right? That is vital because it is yours. And that to me is what's so exciting about the work. But it's also, you know, what is also the most challenging about the work, right? It's really challenging to, you know, meet artists where they are at the variety of spectrums in which we serve and help them out of where they are, right? Because so much of this work is, you know, self-deprecating and really just ourselves getting in the middle of it. And so it is one side really beautiful, but also on the other side very challenging.
You know, the phrase that was bouncing around, I feel like it was just given to me, we become human again, right? If we think about the ways queer Black people are objectified, fetishized, dehumanized, the way that there's only certain queer Black stories that the media machine wants to amplify, that there's an actual scarcity of opportunities, right? Not a fabricated or a scarcity. And that so much of this experience can be dehumanizing and demoralizing, and that I'm so enlivened by the idea that queer Black people encounter you and your team and the community at OTV and feel like they're becoming human again, right? That how they feel matters as much as the stories they want to tell. And the second thing I want to flag is around storytelling. There's a wonderful quote from Chinua Achebe. If you look at the world in terms of storytelling, you have, first of all, the man who agitates, the man who drums up the people. I call him the drummer. Then you have the warrior who goes forward and fights. But you also have the storyteller who recounts the event. And this is the one who survives, who outlives all the others. It is the storyteller, in fact, who makes us what we are, who creates history. The storyteller creates the memory that survivors must have. Otherwise, surviving would have no meaning. This is very, very important. Memory is necessary if surviving is going to be more than just a technical thing.
Oh, I love that. And that resonates with me so incredibly, like, deeply, especially around, like, just outlasting, like, the test of time, right? Because that really is something that isn't on our side, right? It's something that is constantly progressing and constantly changing the ways in which we engage with the world. And so the storyteller really is the individual who is the keeper of our secrets, right? It is the angelic troublemaker who also has the opportunity to say, like, this did happen, or it didn't happen, or it happened this way, or from my recall, right? From my experience, this is what I saw. And, you know, at the end of the day, I think a big part of artistic vitality is shape-shifting, right? It's being able to really allow yourself to mold and change the ways in which your gifts, right, are able to land. That's really what it is.
The thing that's just occurred to me is that we are all already storytellers. If we think about the murder of our sibling, O'Shea Sibley, or indeed any other murder of any other queer Black person since the advent of social media, the stories that we adopt as social media citizens, as citizens of the world of the internet, and that we disseminate, right? That what we choose to share means that we become the storytellers, right? And I think that so many of us have either have had that fact obscured from us. We don't see ourselves as the storytellers. We don't even see ourselves participating per se in the kind of weaving of a kind of larger, more damaging story. But that's actually what we've been made to do, even if we don't intend to, is be the storytellers of very limiting narratives about Black life broadly, but more specifically about who queer Black people can be in the world. That's the kind of aha moment I just had, that we're all already storytelling.
And that's also, I mean, in just the OTV perspective, I think that that's what a lot of people don't understand, is like how much of a privilege it is to have our own platform. You know, like, we aren't beholden to anyone beyond our community. And so we're not waiting for approval. We're not waiting for affirmation. We're not waiting for, you know, industry to validate or affirm the work that we're doing, which then creates a whole other system of gatekeeping, right? Because we now are the keepers of a platform and we choose, right, what is and isn't, right, being platformed in any given moment. And that comes with a huge duty and responsibility that I, right, in my role, am actively trying to learn, because there's this thing that happens and that I've just witnessed over the last several years as an executive, is that, you know, I'm complete, right? I must know everything that that must, you know, exist in the world around intersectionality, right? And every issue at any subject matter of every time of the day, I must have a recall and experience to relate. Like, you know, or anytime I walk into the room of, you know, my transness or my queerness or my blackness must speak for the thousands of people, yeah. Right?
You are so a promise of the future simultaneously.
Exactly. Yep. And that to me comes with a huge, like, invitation to dismantle, right? Because, like, I do not speak for everyone, right? But I understand that when I show up into a space, I am never showing up alone, right? And I'm also not, you know, removed from the fact that that also is where a lot of my anxiety, right, is derived from, right? And that is what fuels a lot of my depression, right? It's because of that weight that society places on bodies that look like ours. And so what is so important for us at OTV is that we are constantly taking moments for ourselves, right, to center and anchor and care, because at the end of the day, no one else is going to do that work for us, right? And if we want to actually change a sector, we have to model that behavior, right? It isn't something that is going to change overnight, and it isn't something that we may even reap the benefits of in our lifetime, right? And fully and holistically. But I know that the small actions that we take towards centering care and anchoring ourselves in something that is beyond production and labor is what allows the storytellers of our time to really show up bravely and authentically. And that to me is like legacy work, right? Like that's the thing that I'm more interested in than just like entertainment.
Yeah. And I want to connect you to Mikel Owuna, the photographer and engineer and artist who in his research into, you know, queer African histories, you know, highlights the role of the queer trans person in Africa historically as the shaman or the gatekeeper, right? The gatekeeper between worlds and planes. And that part of the role of the gatekeeper is as a conduit for messages, communication, to help people in their rituals. So we understand gatekeeper, as you've challenged here, as this someone keeping something from us, guarding an archive that either we are in and we need to get to, or keeping us out of a space that we have title to, or in the kind of queer African sense of gatekeeping as those who guard the gates to enlightenment, to completeness, to wholeness. Yeah, I wanted to offer that to you.
I love that. Yeah. Thank you for that offering. That's beautiful.
So I touched on this very briefly earlier. One of the things, elements, offerings that I've been so attracted to in you is your softness and how you guard that softness and make space for it. And it's a softness that's so intentional. So as our conversation comes to a close, what is it about softness in particular that is so important to you?
Yeah, this is a really beautiful question, and I really enjoy any invitation to lean into the softness, just because so much of my like life and the facade of being an executive diva, right, is around this rigidity and like harshness, and like it's hard, right? Everything has to be so polished and, you know, presented in a really digestible and compact way, and the skin has to be popping, and the beard has to be bearding, and everything just needs to be something. And so I think when I meditate on softness, it is such a beautiful invitation for me to remind myself that, like, I am not invincible, but my strength moves beyond measure, right? Like, yes, I do break, right? I do have moments where I am tender and I have to heal my wounds. But the reason why I show up the way that I do in that guarded sense, right, in terms of guarding my softness, is because I have just experienced so much loss, right? I have experienced so much trauma. I have experienced so much debilitating sorrow in my life that those parts of me, right, are always healing, right? They are always in conversation with what I am experiencing in my world around me. And so in order to just humanize this hardness that I have had to endure, right, and the resilience that I have had to embody, I think it is imperative that I allow myself the opportunity to experience softness and care and nourishment in a way that really informs, right, and activates parts of my body here on this plane, right, on earth, right? This is, you know, we can talk about divining and we can talk about going to these other worlds, but right now, like, what I have learned is that because of the body that I'm in, it is expected for me to endure pain and trauma at exuberant amounts of it as a rite of passage, right? That is how I get my access, right? Like, how much can you burden before you crumble? And that is no longer a way that I want to live. It's unfortunate that I've had to watch so many Black women, Black queer people, Black trans people, Black trans femmes, right, have to burden and shoulder so much of the world's, like, pain and be, again, like you said, that conduit, right, of building a bridge or building opportunities or building anything where nothing exists, right? Which is so much of what I know our experience is to hold. I need something to indulge in, right? That is beyond my function and labor in this world. Like, I don't want to die here and be like, that bitch worked. That's not what I'm here for. You know, I'm really here to spread some of that softness and that sweetness and the wisdom and the gifts that have been imparted upon me, which when I reflect on them, I don't think about, you know, my mother as a resilient woman. Yes, she was, but what she really actually taught me was care, right? How to care for myself and that care for other people, and how doing both and or one at the same time is beneficial to everyone, right? So when I think about softness, and I think about how I can share it, or, you know, why it's so close to me and why I revere it as something so precious, is because I think I'm entitled to it. I'm entitled to be soft.
Yes.
And that's that on that. Yeah. That's on period.
You know what? I want to share something with you. Of saying, if you hold me while I fantasize, I'll guard you while you sleep. Right? Yes. And I thought of that. Absolutely. Because part of, I think, what we're doing together, here's what I'm thinking. I was watching Kokomo City by D. Smith. Mm-hmm. And what didn't come up in reviews very often or at all of any of the reviews that I saw about Kokomo City was the tenderness and intimacy and humor, right? It was all about raw, unapologetic, Black trans, you know, all of the kind of tropes associated when a Black trans woman, sex worker in particular, opens her mouth, right? And what wasn't noticed and what stood out to me was the softness, right? The laughter that what Dee managed to communicate with Kokomo City, I think so beautifully, was that when Black people come together in these intimate moments, we come undone, right? We can be soft in a way that we can't be in the world. And so I'm thinking about softness like that too, that part of the joy of being in community, and I guess linking back to our kind of joint desire for solitude, is that we do need people around us who will guard us while we sleep, right? And who will hold us while we fantasize, and who can say, hey, they're being soft right now, let me step up to the plate. And so softness is something also collective. Softness as a form of communion. Yeah.
And divining. No, I love that reference around becoming undone, because for me, so much of this year in my current life is really getting close to the person I am when no one's watching.
Hey.
Right?
Yeah, sorry.
That is,
just jumped no, on my back.
I mean,
yeah.
The ancestors, and they're on my neck all the time. They're like, they it's usually in the throat.
Yeah.
And they're like, get it out. But it is, because I think so much of what I have learned, and I think we've talked about this before, but like so much around who I am, I learned through thousands of literal strangers, right? Like I have no idea who these people are, but they're telling me who I am, and I unfortunately believe them. And so now, what's such a beautiful invitation to myself is that, like, I actually get to have agency on who I'm becoming, right? Like, I have lived many lives, and I will live many more. And so who I choose to become is a softer, more kind person in this world. And, you know, I was at that current, you know, that leadership retreat, someone mentioned to me how, you know, they were observing me throughout the training, and they were saying, like, you know, yeah, you're a really powerful person. You're a very fierce person. But what makes you actually the most powerful and the most fierce is that you don't exert dominion. It's like you actually model how to be fierce and powerful within yourself so that other people can get in line, right? And I was just like, Come on,
mirror.
Cis man, yeah. Cis straight man coming through with observations and deductions. I was like, you better see it. And a part of that is by literally leading with softness, because I've just witnessed so many people be forceful, right? I've witnessed so many people really exert that power in a way that doesn't land with softness. And like for me, like I go to sleep every night and I sleep real sweetly. Okay, I let this world go and I go to another place and I love it there. And then, you know, spirit brings me back into body, and then I wake up and I'm like, okay, I can do it here, I guess, again. You know what I mean? Like I can be down with this because I hold that softness as like a sacred part of my divination. And that to me, I love that you brought in the undone, because I'm just like, how do we become more undone? I want to be, unravel me, you know, like that's so much of, I think, what we need in this world is just to let it all out. However you can do that with, you know, respect and care.
Yeah. And, you know, and coming undone is not only in this process of living many lives and becoming something else, but also knowing that we can come undone and be put back together, right? Like,
yeah,
that's part of it too. I think that's the resistance to softness can be, I can't come undone here, because who will put me back together? Yeah.
Well, because it's work.
It is work. Yeah.
It is work. Yeah. And that's the other part, is that like, I wish that I could just say that I woke up like this. I mean, close. It's close to.
Doing better.
it's getting better, but it is the work. It's the work, and like you said, it's the guarding of what is sacred that allows, you know, us to show up to this work that we have been called to do. And that to me is where the privilege and the honor lies, is that like, oh, I get to do this, you know what I mean? I think, you know, I have a colleague that I work with, and they imparted some knowledge upon me, Chris Walker, a couple of, maybe 2 years ago or maybe a year ago, but, you know, it was recently around this idea around, like, instead of, like, I have to do this, right? It's, like, I get to do this, right? Like, I get to do this. Like, I'm invited to do this. No one's forcing me to do this. And I love that invitation because it also honors the fact that you have agency within your body to make decisions over the governance of your life, right? And so by you saying you get, it means that you had an option. You could have left, but you chose to stay. And that to me is why I find so much power in softness, because it allows you to actually take a step back and pause around the ways in which, like, the natural response is to fight, right? And you said it so beautifully that, like, we do need people who are fighting, right? And for me, my invitation is that my fight just looks different now.
Elijah McKinnon is the soft and fierce leader of OTV, a nonprofit streaming platform and media incubator for intersectional storytelling. You'll find more information about Elijah and OTV in the show notes. And don't forget to sign up for Field Notes. Busy Being Black is an exploration and expression of queer liveliness. And my guests are those who have learned to live, love, and thrive at the intersection of their identities. Your support of the show means the world. Please leave a rating and a review and share these conversations far and wide. As we continue to work towards futures worthy of us all, my hope is that as many of you as possible understand Busy Being Black as a soft, tender, and intellectually rigorous place for you all to land. Thank you to my friend Lazarus Lynch for creating the ancestral and enlivening Busy Being Black theme music. I'm so busy being black.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.